sound check. Are the batteries and the mic working? Can everyone hear me? Okay, it's also a little dark here, so I'm going to see if I can work out a situation with this light. It's going to involve maybe moving the podium forward.
Oh, or
it will involve Renee coming to say today. That is great. Thank you. Hello and welcome. I am Frances Schoberg. I'm the Literary Director of the Poetry Center, and we are so happy to have Carolyn Forché with us tonight. In a repeat of our weather scare with Naomi Shihab Nye last month, we were afraid that our poet, along with throngs of other Washingtonians, would be grounded in icy DC. But alas, she's here, she braved the ice, and we're thrilled. I've got just a few announcements, and I'll try to keep them brief. Friends of the Poetry Center is now two-thirds through its way to a $20,000 goal for 2006-2007. And I want to thank those of you who have generously supported this reading series. And for those of you who would like more information about Friends of the Poetry Center and how you can help to keep this reading series free and open to the public, please pick up one of these brochures in the lobby, in the hallway lobby. After the reading. Next Saturday, Alice Notley will read at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in downtown Tucson. We're co-sponsoring this reading with POG and Chax Press, and as with all of the POG readings, there will be a nominal $5 charge or $3 for students. And last thing, in addition to presenting her work tonight, Carolyn Forché is scheduled to share her work with inmates in the state prison writing workshops. The prison workshops were founded in 1974 and continue to be led by poet Richard Shelton. The Lannan Foundation supports publication of the Walking Rain Review, this journal, which publishes work by current and former inmates who have honed their skills in these workshops. This writing is extraordinary, and I encourage you to pick up a copy of the journal in the lobby. It is free, so there's no reason not to, and there's a lot of good writing to be found within the pages. Lastly, I want to thank our supporters, the College of Humanities, University of Arizona Foundation, National Endowment for the Arts, Arizona Commission on the Arts through appropriations from the Arizona State Legislature, and of course, Friends of the Poetry Center. Introducing Carolyn Forché tonight is her former student and cornerstone of the Poetry Center, Renee Angle, our events coordinator.
If you are familiar with the work of Carolyn Forché, you may already know that she is commonly referred to as a poet of witness, a term she herself coined. Reviewers have focused on the political content of her poetry, influenced by her human rights work for Amnesty International in El Salvador, and later as an NPR correspondent in Beirut. The formal elements of her work have been just as riveting and controversial. Each one of Forché's books mark a departure from the previous. From her first collection, Gathering the Tribes, full of voluptuous metaphor and first-person narrative, she has slowly disintegrated her stories into long-lined fragments that come to make up the Angel of History. Her most recent book, Blue Hour, is a return to her earlier, more personal lyric, although the landscape remains congested with the crimes of humanity and atrocities of war. Let me also suggest that in addition to being a poet of witness, Carolyn Forché is a mystic. For Forché, the political represents deeply spiritual concerns. Words form transitions between this bardo, this letter, and the next. It is a mystic who deals in ciphers and alphabets. Forché's groundbreaking abecedarian on earth begins, not unpredictably, with the article A, designating the singular, one, and ends with the word zero, the words themselves representing numbers or the mathematical language of a time to come. Lines beginning with words like and as further complicate the equation of images, and readers are left adding, comparing, and dividing. Yet can we assume that these things add up? In arithmetic, to add a zero to the end of a whole number increases the value of that figure or series tenfold. In slang, a zero is a person of no importance or worth. In war, It indicates to set the sights of a rifle at known distances. Forche sets her sights, but it is not through the crucifix of a rifle sight that we witness the world. Instead, readers are privy to the view the speaker affords us, panoramic and spare. There is no linearity here. In the title poem, Blue Hour, the human soul weighs 26 grams. A cathedral can become a dovecote. Later, in On Earth, the 26-gram weight of the human soul maintains its weight, but loses its human link. The birds do not nest, they fly. These lines contradict or mirror each other, drawing attention to the poem as an artifact and questions the reality of the history it presents. Numbers are only one of the alphabets within On Earth. A poem that expands and collapses as the various letters of the Roman alphabet are marked out like an abacus. In The Angel of History, Forche writes, "You see, one can live without having survived. In this line, one is prismed into three. First, the person who can live without being a witness of atrocities. Second, the person who lives through such atrocities and not really surviving or thriving. Third, the person who survives by dying." Through this phrase and ones like it, Forche capitalizes on the way that slang sometimes trivializes our language and reclaims words so that they become flip switches to memory, presenting alternatives that create a sense of simultaneity, yet are monuments to a suggested life. To talk of redemption is a dangerous proposition. The redemption Forche offers is defined by what is illuminated in contrast to the realm of the living. Death is not an obstacle to the memory, to insight. Her words are written often through the act of negation, which necessarily resists memory. What's left once all else has been negated is human, without being soldered to hope. She exhumes these words fragment by fragment. It is a mystic who deals in the otherworldliness of war and reports it bold-hearted and breathless. Please welcome Carolyn Forche.
Special for me to be reading in Arizona. This is my fourth reading for the Poetry Center. I started reading here 26 years ago, and so this is dear to my heart, this place. I did have an adventure getting here, I have to tell you. 600 flights were canceled from the airport from which I was departing. We had a sheet of ice on everything, and was glass, everything was ice, and the airport was closed for a long time that day, and I was trying to find backup flights. There wasn't a single seat available on any plane into Tucson or Phoenix for days. So I thought, if I don't get on this plane, it won't happen. So I struck up a conversation with another gentleman in boarding group seven for my flight, and we turned out to be across the aisles from each other, and we struck up a conversation during the flight, and we ran out of fuel in the air and had to land in Albuquerque to fuel up because of storms in Phoenix, and I thought, this isn't happening. And finally, I said, listen, I have to get to Tucson. You know, do you know Arizona? Can you help me, give me advice? If we land in Phoenix in the middle of the night, how do I get to Tucson? And he said, why do you need to get to Tucson? You live there? And I said, no, I have to be there tomorrow night for a big poetry reading. And he said, where? And I said, at the university. And he said, well, I'm the president of the university. I'm going to take this occasion to talk about the MFA program, the Poetry Center. Something to do with each other, so he's not stupid. And, so I thought, you know, he's really, really, he was lovely, and it was great, and he helped me get on a plane. He really did. He found me a car, you know, and he said, B5, they're taking off in 15 minutes. You know, you have to get there, so it was good. That's how I'm here. You're program. He didn't know about that. And I said, well, how long have you been the president? And he said, 7 months. And I said, well, let me bring you up to speed. So I'm going to begin with a poem, a strange poem called On Earth from Blue Hour. And I want to read after that new poems, give you new poems. On Earth is the bardo in alphabetical order. It's a poem that I wrote a few summers ago in a kind of white heat of writing, and I realized that it was someone dying and their life passing before them in flash, 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 and so I found this form, which was alphabetized all the way in. The lines were alphabetized. Makes it difficult to revise because you can't move things around if they're in alphabetical order, for one thing, and I discovered when I finished the poem that there were actually hymns from Central Asian desert from the 4th century that were written in this form, so to be mnemonic. And so I decided to take credit for knowing that. I put a note in the back saying, well, 4th century hymns, that's the form. But the day I finished the book, I finished this poem. It turned out to be 42 pages. In the beginning, it was 80 pages. And when I finished it, I have a practice with my students of buying used books and then drilling into them and cutting into them and making things out of them, making art objects out of them and playing with them. And I had bought such a book in the Women's Farmers Market in Montgomery County where I live. I paid $2 for it, and it was called something on depth or something. And the day that I finished this poem, this book committed suicide. You know, it just jumped off the shelf and landed flat open on my floor. So I went over and picked it up, and it was flat open to this page. And it was written by George Burgess in 1850. The recollections of a whole life, the consciousness of spiritual existence, and all which is mightiest and deepest in our nature become brighter, even in opposition to extreme bodily languor, in the immediate vicinity of death, the mind enters on an unaccustomed order of sensations, a region untrodden before, from which few, very few travelers have returned, and from which those few have brought back but vague remembrances, sometimes accompanied with a kind of homesickness for the higher sphere, of which they had then some transient prospect. Here, amidst images, dim images, of solemnity or peace, of glory or of terror, the pilgrim pursues his course alone and is lost to our eye. George Burgess, 1850. So I thought, oh my God, that's the epigraph for the poem. And so I didn't drill into the book or saw it in half or anything. I decided to spare its life and kept it. So I still have this book. And I'm going to give you excerpts of this poem from the beginning to through, from the A's through approximately the T's. You won't get to hear the whole thing, but it'll give you a sense of it. And so I selected these passages for you so that you'll be able to move through the dream of the life passing through itself. And I began to feel these aren't just remembered events from my life. It feels to be a collective dreaming. A barn loft of horse dreams with basin and bedclothes, a bit of polished quiet from a locked church, a corpse broken into many countries, a cup of sleep, a desire to live as long as the world itself. A field of birds roasted by the heavens, a goodness that must forget itself, a grave strewn with slipper flowers, a groundskeeper's knowledge of graves. A hurried life, a knife on newsprint, a lace of recent snow, a litany of broken but remembered events, a memory through which one hasn't lived. A parcel of copper wire, plastique, and a clock. A parrot learning its language from a ghost. A random life caught in a net of purpose. A record keeper of human and earthly life. And in the dream, ce voyage nous voulait refaire, laundry hanging for months, and in their eyes the years taken from them. And it is certain someone will be at that very moment pouring milk. And it is supposed that we are describing the world and its corresponding moment in the past. As if with the future we could replace the past, as in the childhood of terror and holiness. As though when past and present converge, there is a gap, as thought affects the universe in as yet immeasurable ways. Between here and here, between hidden points in the soul, between hidden points in the soul born of nothing, between saying and said, beyond what one has oneself done. Both windows open to whatever may happen, bottle light tossed into the sea with no message. Death is not the conclusion of earthly life. Death is the descent of the one called. Down a desert road aerially strafed, drawings doomed to be destroyed by bullets, dreaming nouns remembered until a window, drinking from cupped hands dwelling in apartness, ghost hands appearing in windows rubbing them clear, ghost swift, grisé, guardian spirit, God not a being but a force. And humans, the probative tip of that becoming. History decaying into images in the mathematical language of a time to come. It is as if space were touching itself through us. Linked to flame, linked as flame to burning coal, as one candle lighted from another, memory, the presence of the no more. Resting language or language under surveillance reverses itself as we read it, searching for something one knows will not be found, set in language and deserted by God. The danger of premature good conscience. The dreams are a coffin with an open window. The dreams of a mind in the grave. The flautist breath in a stairwell, the flumes of white phosphorus marking the city, the fragility of social orders, the immigrant disappearing into a new language, the informant's diary of his whereabouts, the little notebook of poems in the pocket of a corpse. The plummet of a star from its darkness, the silence of a new language, the soft houses of heaven. The soul weighs 26 grams and is migratory like the birds, the soul enamored of greatness, the soul with its sense of destination, the soul exiled, a stranger to earth, the tomb into which we escape. Those things are obvious which are invisible. Time, a severe border guard, becomes imaginary. Time lapsed in one country is only beginning in another. To abandon yearning for the body, to be unquiet, to be visible to oneself, to become endlessly what one has been, to cross the field without breaking the snow, to expose ourselves to whatever may happen, to know not only what is, but the other of what is, to know that the great bell is the great bell, to remain haunted, to rescue the future, to say nothing without confining ourselves to silence, to search like a sheep for salt, to see or to perish, to see other than from without, to see the world as it actually is. Um, was invited to come to Arizona, one of the things that I realized was that I haven't read for a while. I'll tell you why in a little while. I haven't read in public. But you know that we're living in very precarious times, precarious for our consciences. I experience a feeling that I'm sure many of you experience, a feeling of profound unease. And so I don't think we can have poetry readings or discussions or talks or panels or anything without mentioning this and without saying something about it. So I would like to read a couple of poems now that arose from my experiences in wars. And the most profound experience for me of a conventional warfare was in Beirut in 1983 and 1984. And I'd like to read something that I called Writing Kept Hidden, because it took me 20 years to write about Beirut. 20 years I couldn't do so. And so these are little poems. The first one, Writing Kept Hidden, is about the time I was in Beirut when the Marine barracks were blown up by a truck bomb and 257 Marines were killed in that event. After the explosion, I went over to the barracks, the ruins of the barracks, and walked around. And the roofs were blown off, the walls were blown away. In the places where the Marines had been sleeping, there were drawings on the walls that the Marines had made themselves. And they were very good drawings. So some of them were artists, and they had drawn themselves, and they had drawn scenes from their lives, and they had put some obscene, language on the walls, and I won't talk about that, but I want to read you a poem that came out of walking around there, Writing Kept Hidden. The black fire of ink on paper took hold of their souls, incorporeal fire. There was no protection this fire couldn't touch, nor darkness, nor a moment. It lasted as long as a dream. It was no dream. Heteroglossia of nervous shortwave, cloud of blown walls. In the barracks, those who had sketched themselves in coal and smoke became coal and smoke. And the living remained, linking unknown things to the known. Residue, scapular, matchlight, name on a tongue. Then, for an hour, the war slept, and rain filled the cisterns with silence. Our windows faced east, and on August evenings, the sky was a blue, no longer spoken. This next one, called Prayer, is from the first Iraq War. Begin again among the poorest. Moments off in another time and place. Belongings gathered in the last hour, visible, invisible. Tin spoon, teacup, tremble of tray, carpet hanging from sorrow's balcony. Say goodbye to everything. With a wave of your hand, gesture to all you have known. Begin with bread torn from bread. Beans given to the hungriest. A carcass of flies. Take the polished stillness from a locked church. Prayer notes left between stones. Answer them and hoist in your net voices from the troubled hours. Sleep only when the least among them sleeps, and then only until the birds. Make the flatbed truck your time and place. Make the least daily wage your value. Language will rise then, like language from the mouth of a still river. No one's mouth. Bring night to your imaginings. Bring the darkest passage of your holy book. These are all new now. The first one is from Beirut again. There were a lot of car bombs when we were there. If the cars all stopped, if a car stopped in the middle of the street, everyone would stop, and all people would run from their cars with the engines running because people were afraid that one of the cars was going to blow up. When the car bombs went off, as now, the ambulances would come, and then another bomb would come off to kill the people who had come to rescue. This poem is called In the Cinema of the Place des Martyrs. The Place des Martyrs is in the center of Beirut, and it was an area of the city that was completely destroyed and uninhabited, except for one street, which was gleaming and shiny and perfect and untouched. It was the street where all the banks were. In the cinema of the Place des Martyrs. That morning, they lifted above their heads what appeared to be a doll in a christening gown. And we stood in the blasted haze, waiting for plumes to stanch the fires quickening through carpets and bedclothes, and we did not turn away, nor did we photograph the child, except at the moment of its being raised. But later walked to the Place des Martyrs, where a stillness had been created entirely by small arms fire, that so blistered walls and blackened shops that no one remained in that part of the city. And we stood before the ruined movie house that had lost all but its blank screen, where once all manner of figures had shone, wavering, composed of light, their speech subtitled, passionate, inane, with nothing to say to the audience we had become. Now I'm going to tell you a little secret. It's not going to be a secret in a minute. I've had an interesting experience during the last 6 months. And this experience has led me to open a lot of boxes in my house. And in those boxes, there are lots of bits of paper and manuscripts and books and photographs and mementos and unfinished poems, bad drafts, bad poems, lots of things. I've been battling cancer for 6 months and going through the usual things that we all go through when we have to do that. And one of the things that occurred to me was, among many things, I thought, I better take care of my boxes now. You know, I better hurry up and do that. And so I began opening things, and I found a lot of notebooks. It was rather beautiful to find these things. And so I'm writing a memoir. I'm writing really fast now. I'm trying to write poems and prose. So I want to share one little excerpt from a notebook with you. This is the last Beirut poem, and it is from. This was. My husband worked for Time magazine. He was a photographer stationed in Beirut, and I was working for human rights organizations in Beirut at the time. And we came under shell fire for a week, so this was a little bit of that time. It's a notebook entry, but it might be something else. I'm not sure. So here it is. It's very immediate. It's not shaped. It's not from a notebook, 1984. This had once been a nightclub in Ras Beirut. Broken piano, Scheherazade walls, women wearing veils but nothing else, all with the same body. All night, then all night, and the streets iced green by blown glass, a rack of clothes in a fingering wind, staccato of an occasional Kalashnikov, the initials of militia. This is my worthless identity card. These my dying batteries. That one, drunk, is tuning his shortwave into bits of world. Radio Frankfurt, Radio Split, what was once Yugoslavia, Radio Crete, what was Leningrad, no New York. February 11th, the nuclear weapons on the 6th Fleet ordered to higher readiness. Cordite-laced wind, and the one who would soon be chained to a radiator is making notes to himself. Charlie Gunn. ABC News, and the one who shared satellite access with me, Terry Anderson, Associated Press. And all night the trees burned so that birds couldn't land in them. There was no water in the pool below us, so there could be no face. All night we were shelled where the sea could be heard. Many story department blocks flattened into a pastry resembling what the French call millefeuille. Sandbagged hotel, live telephone, taped glass, crates of gold bullion, Kalashnikovs and cognac, making these notes by matchlight. It is as if I am not here, but in Paris, walking under the sawed-off trees. What was worth this? A prayer call? Paradise? I had a friend, Daniel Simcoe. He was the translator of the great Austrian poet Georg Trakl. Georg Trakl, the book that he translated is called Autumn Sonata. It's really beautiful. I'm going back now to 1989, the Soviet empire is collapsing. And both Daniel's family and my family, both from former Czechoslovakia. And Daniel came right after the Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968. He was a kid when he came to the United States. He became a really close friend of mine. And when the wall started coming down in Germany and the Velvet Revolution happened in Prague, Daniel said, we have to go there right now because I have to go get my jazz records from the attic where I left them. And I said, Daniel, they've been there for 22 years. They've been in the attic for 22 years. They're probably not good anymore. And he said, no, it's a great collection. Plus I have books and many things. We have to go. And he said, besides, you can find your family. So we went, and Daniel had two suitcases, one full of clothes and one full of books, you know, various books that he wanted to give to people there, and have for himself and give away and so on. So we went through Vienna. We were going to go to Vienna, rent a car, drive across the bridge, and go into Bratislava. That turned out not to be a good plan, but I don't have time to tell you why. Anyway, we were in this hotel, and Daniel was a smoker, you know, chain smoked. So he was always looking for a light from everybody all the time. And he put down the suitcases on the sidewalk in front of the hotel in Austria, went looking for a light, and one of the suitcases disappeared. It was the one with the books in it. So I wrote this poem. I thought about that for years. Daniel died suddenly in 2004. And so I'm going to read a couple poems in his honor and for him. But the first one is called The Lost Suitcase. And it is about the experience of losing the suitcase. He talked about that suitcase the whole trip. I wish I had the suitcase. You know, the problem is I don't have the books. You know, this went on and on. You probably traveled with somebody like that in your life at some point. But it became funny. And so this is the lost suitcase. So it was with the suitcase left in front of the hotel. Cinched, broken locked, papered with world ports, carrying what mattered until then. When turning your back to cup a match, it was taken, and the thief, expecting valuables, instead found books written between wars. Gold attic light, mechanical birds singing, and the chronicle of your country's final hours. What, by means of notes, you hoped to become. A noun on paper. Paper dark with nouns. Swallows darting through a basilica, your hands up in smoke, a cloud about to open over the city, pillows breathing shallowly where you had lain, a ghost in a hospital gown, and hear your voice, principled, tender, soughing through a fence woven with pine boughs. Writing is older than glass, but younger than music. Older than clocks or porcelain, but younger than rope. Dear one who even in speaking is silent, for years I have searched, usually while asleep, when I have found the suitcase, open, collecting snow, still holding your vade mecum of the infinite, your dictionary of the no longer spoken, a commonplace of wounds casually inflicted, and the slender ledger of truly heroic acts. Gone is your atlas of countries unmarked by war. Absent your manual for the preservation of ours. The incunabulum is lost, both your earliest book and a hatching place for your mechanical birds, but the collection of apersus having to do with light laying its eggs in your eyes was found, along with the prophecy that all mass murders were early omens. In an antique bookshop, I found your catechism of atrophied faiths. So I lay you to rest without your psalter, nor the monograph wherein you state your most unequivocal and hard-won proposition, that everything must happen, but to whom doesn't matter. Here are your books, as if they were burning. Be near now. And wake to tell me who you were. So, Adrianska was the woman from Slovakia who was with him when he died, his friend. This is called Deathbed. I should tell you a tiny little story. Daniel was 11 when the Warsaw Pact countries invaded Czechoslovakia. And he wanted to do something. His father was very active against this. And what he did was he and his friends went out in Bratislava, and they turned all the street signs around and stole some of them. And the Soviets got lost invading Bratislava. They had tanks and trucks and armored vehicles and everything. So they mistakenly crossed into Austria. And so actually, they invaded a NATO country, you see. And when they found out 3 kilometers in where they were, they turned around and raced back. Very few people know about this little invasion that happened. But it could have been World War, whatever. Okay, this is Deathbed. So, Adrianska, you were with him in his final hours, and I give you that. Speaking the language I understood only in the kitchen of childhood. For you, a lamp-lit language spoken in tomato gardens and prison camps by those sent away and those who let them be sent. So many words for no one and nothing. Until history came for them too. With its years of industry and waste, a tram pulling black smoke behind itself. These are the suitcases manufactured in communist times from balsa and tin. Here are the books, ink on vellum, sold by hoodlums on the black market. We must have crossed the bridge a dozen times those nights, but can you imagine? Alone, with no one from whom to borrow a match. There appeared a Russian deserter from Afghan War who drew caricatures for small change but never drew our likeness. And some nights there was singing beneath stone angels, but we were otherwise alone. Our Svetko's memories were of the scent of garlic fields beside the river and of riding in the basket of his father's bicycle along its banks. On the night of the invasion, there was a radio and Red Star Jeeps that would become White Star Jeeps in the West. He with his friends turned the street signs around, and the enemy, by mistake, marched into Austria, the only such invasion in the history of that war. So it is over, as you tell me. When he closed his eyes, there were swans. You took his hand on the last bridge and made him laugh. You have my yes, Adrianska. So he, as I told you, he translated Trakl. Trakl was a poet who, well, he was a little bit crazy like most of us poets, but he was made more insane because he was a practicing chemist, pharmacist, and he was put in charge during the First World War of a medical tent, a sort of makeshift medical hospital, where there were 90 wounded soldiers, and he was given no anesthesia and no medicines to take care of them, and it drove him mad. Daniel translated him, and you'll hear a lot of Trakl in here. This is called Elegy for an Unknown Poet. Daniel was an unknown poet. It's a beautiful thing to be. He wouldn't send his poems anywhere. He put them all in drawers. He would never let me send them anywhere. He worked as a librarian at the New York Public Library, and he lived alone and wrote and translated, and he didn't care about publishing and all of that. And I really honor him for his purity, his soul, his devotion to his art that had nothing to do with anything that was going to happen in his lifetime. You who are apart, wanderer, stranger, who bent down in winter for the lost glove of another, you are Einflendale on earth. As if you had been written toward us. Listen, bells. You are sheltered once again in the stillness of childhood, where the slow river remains, rain singing from a gutter spout, wet bottles, misted grillwork. Apartness gathers the music of solitude as if it were a glass viola. Bells ring that are and are not, and the soul is left wandering in the blue night. You are the one watching, the one dreaming this, the homeless one left behind. The soul has departed, thinking alone with your thoughts, the poverty of waking life, here, where it nears the eternal. A man stood behind you holding a knife. You walked into the lake until only your hat could be seen. The dead began to wander quietly in the hall of stars. Your sister took her life, and then you couldn't bear the gaze of others. What you could bear, and for long hours, were the star-filled eyes of a toad. I am your translator. Pity me. It is impossible to slip Einflendale into the mouth of another. Last summer, I went with you to the crematorium. We said poems and covered your body with gloves and roses. I know that you are dead. Why do you ask and ask what can be done? Black is the color of footsteps, frost, stillness, and tears. It modifies branches and wings. Blue appears as cloud, flower, ice. Deer stepping from the forest are also blue. A river is green, but green as well are flecks of decomposition. Silver the blossoming poppies, a wind's voice, faces of the unborn, death is their province. The living, you say, appear unreal to you as if they were on fire. Yet the living gaze at the dead, imploring them to appear. Why, you ask? The dead do not understand this. The living are oblivious to what they are, measuring time as a flickering of day and night. Brown are the cesspools, rafters and shadows, golden the day, candles and a tent of stars. Ivory, the hands and limbs of lovers. Purple, a night wind, nostrils and snails. A skiff is red, as are wolf and wound. Yellow are the walls of summer. Sleep is white, as is sickness, shirt, and revenant. What is left us then but darkness? One's self is always dark and near. There's a poet who just got a teaching job at San Diego State, where I started my teaching career. His name is Ilya Kaminsky. Ilya Kaminsky has a book called Dancing in Odessa. It's a good book. I met Ilya when he was 19 years old, and he was just here freshly from Odessa, and he was completely deaf, without hearing at all. He had mumps when he was 3 years old, and they were not treated well in the Soviet Union. He lost his hearing completely. Well, I teach a workshop in the summers at the New York State Summer Writers Institute, and you know, you go to the workshop and everyone introduces themselves, and in summer workshops you get quite a collection of people from different walks of life who love poetry and want to write and care about it. And they all introduce themselves and say different things about themselves. And, well, I wrote in high school, and I really haven't been back to it in a long time, and I really want to go back to it, so I'm doing so now that I'm retired, and so on. And we got to Ilya around the table. He was last. And he said, "My name is Ilya. I am from Odessa, former Soviet Union. I write poetry for God." So I said, "Okay, class, let's open our books." Everyone looked at him. No one had ever said that before in the introductions. And he became this sort of angel in my life, and we studied together for 7 years, and I took him back to Odessa a couple of years ago because I thought he should go back, and because Odessa had become this dream for him, a dream city. And so we went back, and this is a little poem from our time. I also took him to St. Petersburg because this is the, for him, the golden city of the great Russian poets of the 20th century, Anna Akhmatova, Olga Mandelstam, Marina Tsvetaeva. So we went, this is about being in, walking in St. Petersburg, and Ilya talking about it. Fisherman, it's called, for Ilya. March, the Neva still white, crisp as communion. And as we walk its bridges, steadying ourselves on the glaze, tubes of ice slide from the gutter spouts to the astonishment of dogs, some of whom have not seen spring before, while others pretend not to remember. And a woman bends over her late potatoes, sorting and piling, and you say, "In this house lived a friend of my father who was killed, and in that house lived another, and in this a very bad poet, no longer known." We come to the synagogue and go in, as far back as a forgotten holiness, where we are told you can whisper into the wall and be heard on the other side. But the rabbi doesn't know you are deaf. We whisper into the wall to please him. A sign in Cyrillic asks for donations, and in exchange we apparently buy tens of matzos wrapped in paper. There are only 100 of us left in the city. While we are here, a fisherman waits on the river, seated with a bucket beside him, his line in the hole. But in the last hour, water has surrounded his slab of ice. So unbeknownst, he is floating downstream, having caught nothing, cold and delirious with winter thoughts, as they all are and were. And as for rescue, no one will come. It is spring, the Neva white and crisp as communion. This next poem is strange for me. It's called The History of Invention. This is more or less in order of what humans have accomplished in their history. It's sort of tongue-in-cheek. In the beginning, cave paintings and harpoons, potter's wheels, beer, and maps. Then boats, silk and ink, bathtubs and alphabets, chests, stirrups, gold coins, roof tiles and libraries, followed by democracy, kites, mausoleums, aqueducts, gunpowder, vellum books, a world map. After that, astrolabes, earthen lamps, circular cities and prayer beads, whiskey and stained glass, windmills, porcelain, cheese. Then banks, followed by true lock gates and chambers, paper money, sonnets, the compass, and a Bible for the poor. Spectacles and watermarks, caricatures, artillery, gun-carrying ships, and the first history of the world. Then followed padlocks, wooden toy cannons, toy dolls with movable arms, playing cards and printed music, wallpaper, carillon bells, a hymn book, cesarean section, diving bells and artificial limbs, the camera obscura, pencils, the pendulum. Then calendar reform, time bombs and newspapers, slide rules and classified ads, bayonets, barometers, wheelchairs, invisible ink, postage stamps, pressure cookers, statistics, champagne and clarinets, jeweled watches, tuning forks, arsenic, boxing gloves, scissors, sextants, fire escapes, false teeth, the infinite velocity of light. rather the finite velocity of light, then balloons, rockets, bifocals, bourbon, parachutes, and mass production. The wave theory of light, gaslit streets, and morphine. Canned food, kaleidoscopes, cocoa, and microphones. Morse code, Christmas cards, saxophones, rubber bands. I think that's where we stopped. This is called the Museum of Stones. I have a friend, instead of buying souvenirs in gift shops when he travels, he picks up stones and he labels them beautifully. Stone from this church, stone from this road, stone from this graveyard. And they're lovely Museum of Stones. So I started picking up stones when I travel too. It's cheaper than souvenirs and more interesting, except that I am not as organized as he is. So I have a lot of stones now, but I don't know where any of them are from. And so they're all together, and I can't tell them apart. And they're from all different countries and things. And so I don't know quite what to do with them. If anybody has any ideas, let me know. But this is for him. It's called the Museum of Stones. These are your stones, assembled in matchbox and tin, collected from roadside, culvert and viaduct, battlefield, threshing floor, basilica, abattoir. Stones loosened by tanks in the streets, from a city whose earliest map was drawn in ink on linen. Schoolyard stones in the hands of a corpse. Pebble from a polonaise's wee. Stone of the mind within us, carried from one silence to another. Stone of cromlech and cairn, schist and shale, hornblende, agate, marble, millstones, ruins of choirs and shipyards, chalk, marl, mudstone from temples and tombs, stone from the silvery grass near the scaffold, stone from the tunnel lined with bones, lava of a city's entombment, chipped from lighthouse, cell wall, scriptorium, paving stones from the hands of those who rose against the army, stones where the bells had fallen, where the bridges were blown, those that had flown through windows, weighted petitions, feldspar, rose quartz, blue schist, gneiss, and chert, fragments of an abbey at dusk, sandstone toe of a Buddha, mortared at Bamiyan. Stone from the hill of three crosses and a crypt, from a chimney where storks cried like human children, stones newly fallen from stars, a stillness of stones, a heart, altar and boundary stone, marker and vessel, first cast load and hail, bridge stones and others to pave and shut up with, stone apple, stone basil, beech berry, stone brake, stone bramble, stone fern, lichen, liverwort, pippin and root, concretion of the body, as blind, as cold, as deaf, all earth a quarry, all life a labor, stone-faced, stone-drunk with hope that this assemblage of rubble, taken together, would become a shrine or a holy place, an ossuary, immovable and sacred, like the stone that marked the path of the sun as it entered the human dawn. Litany in Krakow. The yes of the living, the no of the wall, the yes of the bridge, the no of the water below the bridge, the yes of the wind, the no of wire, the yes of bells, the no of the bolted door, the yes of air, the no of answer, the yes of swallows, the no of stone. The unknown, a train on a bridge, shining upside down in the water, quick joys of pine through mist, a navigable light, a brush-stroked thought, this river, passing us all hours, barges loaded with sadness, moving slowly enough, smaller worrying boats, even a house or two casting off, and the sails so tethered and the sea so coming. I brought back from despair a basket so small that it could have been woven of willow. after René Schau. This body was a flock of gulls over open sea. The cries those of hunger entering clouds. Wind moved seagrass as nameless grasses, and an inlet is shimmering still. From the waters, clouds lifted, then were caught in the skirted slopes. There were thoughts of departure through the luminous gorse, but a chaos of crows darkened. One discovered within himself the power to free others. One stepped away from her flesh, but remained. 30 years have passed between these clouds. There is nothing that cannot be seen from here. How did you know, solitary, that we who were without clarity were about to speak? What comes? To speak is not yet to have spoken. The not yet of a white realm, of nothing left. Neither for itself nor another. To die is not yet to have died. A there is trembling in the sense realm, mourning without end. To come and go is not yet to have arrived, and always is already there, back and forth, behold, beheld, breath to breath. To know is not yet to have known, but a hovering of wakefulness over this. As between languages, to take is not yet to have taken now into an open yes. It is not as forever as the past, nor as long as absence. Here is what I think, to be exposed to the coming of what comes. Thank you.